In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
Standing in that queue in Pop Idol really was a young girl who just thought, if I get to meet Simon Cowell today and I can go home and tell my mates in the pub that Simon Cowell rejected me and said no to me, I'm going to dine out on this for months to come. Initially, I was like, oh my God, that is the best lookalike I've ever seen. Like, Pop Idol have went really over the top. And then the closer he got, I was like, oh my God, it's Elton John. Dominic Mohan in The Sun had written this article saying, look, you know, can she sing? Yeah, is she talented? I suppose so. But come on, lads, you just wouldn't, would you? And then it was a question of the sexualisation of this 23-year-old wee girl who all I was asking the world was, do you think I can sing? All of that stuff was just fair game. It was rife. Everyone was going to do it. You put yourself on telly, you deal with the consequences of it, which would have been fine if I was someone that was even a tiny bit equipped to deal with that, but I wasn't eyeing for a singing contest.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a woman I first met 20 years ago in a queue to audition for the second series of Pop Idol in Glasgow. It was 2003. Will Young had won the first series, beating Gareth Gates in a nail-biting live final, and the country had fallen in love with Pop Idol. So the appetite for a second season, and more importantly, a second idol, was, well, voracious. I was working as the host of Pop Idol's spin-off sister show, Pop Idol Extra, and I followed her from queuing hopeful all the way to becoming Idol's second winner, bagging millions of votes on the night and leaving the show sharing a manager with Annie Lennox and with Simon Cowell as her A&R man. Not only could she sing, she could shine. Her natural quick humour and resilience in the face of so much judgment surrounding her shape made the nation fall under her spell. More people voted for her to win Pop Idol than had voted at the general election, and her debut single, All This Time, went straight in at number one. So that was 20 years ago, and so much has happened since, as we're about to hear. She's now 43, lives and works in Scotland, hosting her own radio show on Radio Scotland, appears on Radio 4's Loose Ends, has performed her one-woman show at the Edinburgh Fringe for 10 years and is now happily married to Jeff, with whom she shares two beautiful young sons. I cannot wait to catch up with her. So let's dial her in. It's Michelle McManus. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to you.
Good. Hello, my darling. This is so exciting.
Isn't it lovely to talk to you?
Yeah, it is. It's really lovely.
I should explain. We reconnected very recently. You slid into my DMs.
I certainly did.
I mean, we've always chatted back and forth on social media. We've kept in touch. And for a very long time after you won the show, we spent a lot of time together as friends in a social group, you know, helping you bed into your new life in London as a megastar. But let's rewind to a couple of months back. You slipped into my DMs and you said, can we have a chat?
I did, because what had happened was, because this year's my 20th anniversary, I went in Pop Idol, which is in itself, I know, I can't believe either. So we sat down with the BBC and they were like, it's going to be a mixture of archive, looking back, looking forward. Do you have a list of people that you would like to speak to at that time? And genuinely, and I'm not just saying it because we're doing the podcast, I was like, it needs to be Kate Thornton, because if it wasn't for Kate, I don't know what I would have done in London, because you... And I don't even know if you were aware of it at the time, because you were, and you still are, you know, but you were such a mega star and you were hosting the show and we were spending so much time together. So to us, you were like, oh my God, here comes Kate Thornton. Like, it never got, oh, here comes Kate, because you were always Kate Thornton. We full named
you. Like, really?
Oh, you were always Kate Thornton.
Really?
You were like,
oh no, coolest. I thought it was one of the gang.
Oh no, you were, but you were like the superstar of one of the gang, because we were just like, you would chat to us like, I'm your mate, and then you'd be like, okay, good to go. And then you would just start presenting, and we were just watching you in awe. And then you kind of did this really lovely thing where you said, look, babe, do you know where you're going to be staying when you move to London? Have you got any friends down here? And I was like, nope, 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 I don't know anything. And you said, I will tell you what, you're going to move to South London, and you're going to come with me, and I'm going to take care of you. And you, that's exactly what you did for me. And I don't know what I'd have done in those first few months in London without that community you gave me in the south side, you know, over in the south of London, and that support. And I was 23, you know, I didn't know anyone, and you allowed me to make that transition.
You know what I remember is that, yeah, we spent a huge amount of time together, right? Because we were locked in the Idol bubble, and it was a different bubble this time around for me, because the first Pop Idol, nobody, you know, we were just growing and going through it. By the second season, it was massive. So that bubble really was quite insulated. Mm-hmm. And I knew what you were stepping into, because I'd seen what had happened to Will and Gareth, and God rest his soul, Darius, the year before. And I think, yeah, I mean, I always felt like I really did want to offer a duty of care as your friend on set. Like, I wanted to be a friend on set for everybody. That was really important. And then we would just spend, I mean, 5-6 days a week together.
Yeah.
I mean, I was recording 12 hours of output with you guys with,
oh, frankly, so much
no scripts. Like, we would just make it up on the spot. On it was the first show ITV2 had ever done like that, the first spin-off show. And, you know, like, I remember we'd come into work and they'd go, oh, my God, have you seen the ratings? I'd be like, oh, no, they're terrible. This is on the first season. They're like, are you kidding? Like, so anyway, that's what I remember about that time. And I'd seen what had happened to Will and Gareth. And I think I felt very protective, as did a lot of the crew on the show, like Claire Horton, who was the exec producer there.
Love Claire. I think you're right, because you maybe had seen what had happened in the first season, and it was such a huge show at the time, and people forget it was a time before social media and stuff, which actually I'm kind of glad, I'm grateful that we didn't have social media at that point, now knowing what I know now. But if it wasn't for you, yeah, can you imagine, right? Can you imagine me dealing with the weight thing and being on social media? I don't think my mental health would have took it. But what you guys created and that duty of care, which actually wasn't really your job to do, but you did it anyway, even though you had all this other stuff going on. Like, you had like the most famous mates coming into the studio. Like, one day you're like, oh yeah, Ricky Gervais coming in, and you know, such and such. And I'm like, oh my God, Kate, who do you don't know? Because of your background is matched. And I'm like, oh my God, your like address book must be wild, you know, because all these, like, you were just like bringing famous people in right, left and centre, because they were your mates. You know, that was the power you had on the show.
But also, they wanted to be there because the show was that show. Do you know, it was the show that everybody wanted to be on. It was the appointment to view. It truly was. And you say it wasn't our job, but do you know what? I think any decent human being would do the same. It's not about a job. Yeah. It's about just, and you'd do the same, by the way. I know that in a heartbeat. And I got to know your mum and dad as well. So by the time it looked like you were, you know, definitely going to get a career out of this, before you'd even won, I could see, like, your mum and dad thinking, God, is she going to be all right? And there were all manner of things being reported about you that, as a parent, as you and I most definitely understand now, must have been really hard. And you're hundreds of miles away. And, you know, mostly the only time they saw you during that time was literally on the side of stage in the Idol studios, because it was so all-consuming. But now you're making a doc about it 20 years on, so it must be nuts going back. Because that's... So listen, long story short, that's why you slid into my DMs. You said, I'm making a documentary. I'd love you to be featured, will you? And I was like, yeah, sure. And then it was so emotional seeing you.
Yeah.
We cried.
I talked a lot about it to the crew afterwards, because we'd filmed quite a lot of the doc before we kind of got to you in London. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this documentary, I mean, the majority of this documentary is just so wholly positive, right? Because Pop Idol changed my life for the better. There's no question about that. But some of it has been really triggering, if I'm honest, Kate, to go back and look at the press at that time. And just to think of me now, 20 years on, as this wee girl at 23, and thinking, oh, God, that was such a shame, actually, with some of the things that happened. But apart from that, it has been kind of really positive. But there was something happened to me when I saw you that day, because I just couldn't stop crying, because I was just overcome. And I think I was overcome by all these emotions, mainly that I was also safe and a really safe pair of hands with you, because that's always the way that you made me feel. And I think because I've watched you, and I feel like I've never lost contact with you because of social media, and I'm always looking at all the amazing things that you're doing online, and you like my stuff and I like your stuff, and I've always felt there was that connection.
Comment and yeah.
Absolutely. But to physically see you in the flesh, and by because you haven't aged in 20 years, I think that threw me as well. I was like, she must have a painting rotting somewhere in a bloody a loft or a basement somewhere, because she's not aged. But I think because you looked the exact same, you sounded the exact same, you were as warm as you were, it kind of catapulted me back to that time. And I was like, oh, it's Kate. And that's just the way I felt. And I just couldn't stop crying, as you know. I was a bubbling wreck.
Well, so was I right alongside you. We were all in the same bubble experience. And it was brilliant. And I don't know what reality shows went on to become much beyond that, because I stopped working on them a couple of years later. But I know that Idol was, you know, I can look you in the eye and said, you know, as far as I know, everybody did everything they could to look after you and make sure that you had the best experience possible, despite what was going on. And by everybody, I mean the production team. I'm not talking about the judges or anybody else outside of that. And
The production team. I've still got the picture up on my wall of all the production team, because that picture means, it was like taken, I don't know if you remember it, you're in it too, and it's like, it was the last picture taken of me before I won. So it was taken like 5-10 minutes before we went on air. And there is like 100-odd strong crew in this picture. Everyone, I could still name everyone in that picture, you know. And it's like, you can look in all of her eyes. I mean, the only person that's missing, Simon Cowell, obviously, because he was never early. Do you remember? He was always in it.
Always having a bath or something.
The titles were rolling. Yeah, the titles were rolling, and he's like putting out the mental ciggy before he just walks into the studio, and everyone, he's like, calm down, can't you know when he was walking in? He's the only one not in the picture.
Apparently his lateness has only got worse with his increased stardom. But you know, this isn't just your experience, this doc you're making, because after, you're so bougie, Mish, after you left me, you were going over to Robbie Williams's house, and you'd already gone and chatted to Susan Boyle. So you've got some big names in there. And you and Robbie, right? Because I know he did like a year, a blink and you miss it year or two maybe on X Factor. But what's your connection with him?
So my connection with Robbie was for after I'd won the show, before I got the house, because you were helping me find a house in over in Clapham
South
way.
London.
I lived in Key West. Do you remember that hotel that everyone kind of got put
Shepherd's
up in?
Shepherd's Bush.
In Key West. Yeah, in Shepherd's Bush. And I was like, okay. And Lisa Armstrong at the time was my makeup artist. So Lisa had said...
Lisa Armstrong is, we should explain, was Ant's girlfriend and then became his wife. And is one of the best makeup artists in the business. She's now the head of, and has been the head of makeup on Strictly since it began, pretty much, I'm sure. So you were being face painted by one of the masters of the craft and one of the nicest.
and one of the nicest. I adore Lisa Armstrong. Lisa and a beautiful girl called Faye and Lindsay Barker were my, they did the clothing for me, so it was like we had this little team going on. And Lisa had said, look babe, why are you sitting in that hotel on your own? Just, we're only in Chiswick, you know, just come over to us and do your makeup in hers in the morning. Because at that first 3 months after winning Kate, which I'm sure you know, was explosive in terms of promo. I was in buses up everywhere. And down the country, I was everywhere. So every day I started off in Chiswick getting my hair and makeup done and off we set. But I was having like a cup of tea and Dec lives next door and this is all like normal to everyone but me, because I'm like, what is happening in my life? And for a time, Robbie Williams was there, and I don't really know why Robbie was there, but he was kind of with that and Dec a lot at that period. And one day I was just getting my makeup done and he'd just like pull a chair up, a cup of coffee, and just started chatting to me, telling me how much he loved it. I mean, it wasn't specifically me. It was just he was obsessed with that format and TV talent shows, and he used to get the tapes sent over to America. And he at that time was just like, and I think he subsequently said to me since that point, I think he just saw that I was getting a bit of a battering in the press. And it was kind of 2003, like Nebworth and all that for him. I think he was going through the same. I mean, the fact that he even puts me in the same sentence as him in terms of how we were feeling as equals in the industry, I'm like, no, no, Robbie, no. Like, I don't know how to tell you this, but we are not, but he won't have any. He just, that's the way he talks to me. So for this very short period of time, I was meeting Robbie Williams through Lisa and Ant and Dec, and then nothing for 19 years. And then 19 years later, I'm in the BBC and my producer says to me, Robbie Williams is coming to the Oval Hydro and you're interviewing him. He seems to know you. And I was like, and I didn't want to say, my producer said, do you know him? And I was just like, not really, because I didn't want to say yes in case I thought, no, maybe he's just PR guys just picked me and Robbie doesn't.
Yeah, but you always think they're going to forget you, don't you? You're like, no, yeah. I don't remember. I only sat with him and had my makeup done for a year.
Yeah. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, he did remember, and he was, you know, for everything that man's been through, like kindness, Kate, is just pouring out of that man, and he is just so, he was so incredibly kind to me during that interview. He invited me backstage to his concert in Glasgow. I took all my sisters, they lost their mind. We were with him for about 45 minutes backstage, and I kept thinking, do you want us to go now? And he's like, no, babe, you're fine, just chatting away. And then months and months later, when I kind of kept in touch with Michael, his man, you know, one of his team, and Michael had said to me, what are you up to? I said, I'm doing this dog, I'm interviewing X, Y, and Z. He said, I think Rob would love to do that. And I was like, sorry? And even up until the last minute, he was like, just come to Rob's house in Holland Park. And I was like, Robbie Williams' house. And at the whole time, my director and my team were like, what are we going to do? What's happening? I'm like, I don't know. I don't want to ask any more questions. Let's just go and see what happens. And even up until the very last minute, I thought, this is not going to happen. And then, oh my goodness, it happened. And then, so he gave us an hour of his time. He was unbelievably kind and generous and just so amazing with his comments about me. We all left the house and were just like, oh my goodness, did that happen? Did we just sit in Robbie Williams' house? And he then was going off to the One Show to promote his documentary. Like, yeah, catch you later, babe. And then I'm away to Australia on Monday. And that was it. That he was so incredibly out of this world. How does that happen?
Well, it happens because you happened, you know. You're special, Michelle. That's why, you know, one of the things that was really evident when we sat down and spoke for the documentary was that I think you've lost sight of how you captured people's hearts and minds and votes, by the way. And I wondered if in this episode we could just take a wander back down memory lane together and start to piece and place all of that together, because that's kind of what we did on the documentary. And the documentary is going to be shown on BBC Scotland, but also BBC iPlayer. I think it goes out on Christmas Eve. Is that right?
It's like Christmas night, and actually there's no talk of it getting out on BBC One because of all you guys being in it.
Aww.
So not because of me. When I said it was my documentary, like, yeah, it'll get out on BBC Scotland, and now I've got Kate Thornton, Robbie Williams, Susan Boyle, the Loose Women Gang, all these people, and they're like, yeah, maybe we should consider BBC One. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds great to me, because all these amazing people that are in the documentary.
So three questions coming your way, my friend. And the first one, I just want to pick up where we first met and rewind slightly from there. So question number one. I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about the girl I met in the queue in Glasgow. Who was she? What was her backstory? And most importantly, what were her ambitions?
So the girl you met in that queue, God love her, she was 23 years old. I was 23 years old, and I had come from this big, gorgeous family in the east end of Glasgow. It was my mum and my dad, and I've got four sisters, so there was five girls. And we just
basically the Nolans.
Yeah, we're basically, we wish we wanted to be the Nolans growing up, right? That's what we did. We used to all line up and sing together and all that stuff. So we grew up in this really working class, beautiful family, big Catholic family, hundreds of aunties, hundreds of cousins. We all lived a stone throw away from each other. You know, my mum and dad were just, you know, we never had a lot, but my dad, the one thing I really remember my childhood is, everything was magical. Everything was a huge deal. Halloween was a huge deal. My dad would spend hours clearing out the garden shed and decorating. We'd be duking for apples and all this kind of stuff. Easter was a huge deal. Christmas was huge in our house. Like, I think my mum and dad, there was a lot of magic in my childhood. That's what I remember. I have a lot of happy memories, and I actually feel, looking back now as a parent, I'm like, oh my goodness, if I can give my boys a tenth of that, because it really was an unbelievable upbringing. You know, just the way how my mum and dad, you know, drove it home for us, that we were a big family and we did everything as a family. And, you know, and I'm so eternally grateful to them for that. So I was a pretty strong person. I was very comfortable in my own skin. You know, I was very overweight, but I was never at any point made to feel in my family that you have to lose weight. My weight was never discussed. This is Michelle, she's beautiful, she can do anything she wants to do. But I think I knew in my mind at 23 there was no way I was ever going to be a singer and be famous because of how I looked and because of where I came from. So therefore I didn't have this great expectation that anything would happen. So I kind of left school and got a job in hospitality, and I was really going through the ranks in these big kind of five-star hotels. And I was sales manager at the Marriott Group at the time for Glasgow, Edinburgh and Aberdeen. So I had a really good job, and I used to sing on the side. I'd go to karaoke bars, I'd do work in men's clubs. You know, I'd have to play my bingo at half-time in the middle of the competition, you know. Couldn't breathe
a
word during the bingo.
Great place to learn your craft, right? Because you've got to work a room that's not there for you. Like, they've not come for you, they've come for the pies and the bingo.
Oh my goodness, as was I there for the pies and the bingo. But like, if they did not like you, Kate, you knew about it immediately that they did not like you. It was like Phoenix Nights completely in these clubs. So standing in that queue in Pop Idol really was a young girl who just thought, if I get to meet Simon Cowell today and I can go home and tell my mates in the pub that Simon Cowell rejected me and said no to me, I'm going to dine out on this for months to come. So
you were just there for the anecdote, really. You thought that at best it was going to be that.
Yeah, I would never have allowed myself to think that it could have been. Because see, really at that point, there was no one on telly that looked like me, or certainly that I wasn't seeing anyone that looked like me. There was no one that really sounded like me. And so therefore I just thought, I'm going to go and audition. My granny's there with me. We're a wee trolley and we're sandwiches and everything like that. And we're going to have a lovely day out. And that's all I thought. And genuinely, that's all I thought.
See, when I met you, I saw a young woman who was confident, funny, so funny. You radiated. You were, you know, I was drawn to you. You were witty. I loved you and wanted you to do well before I'd even heard you sing. Okay, so you're that sheer force of personality. And that comes from everything you've just described in your childhood. Your weight was never discussed. You were just loved, right? You were confident and comfortable and celebrated by the people that knew you. And that really showed. That really showed. And my great hope is that this experience that came next has not taken that away from you.
It hasn't, but I think what it allowed, because of the way I was kind of raised and because of how comfortable I felt, I never wanted to be famous. I didn't want any more. I felt very content from a young age. Like, I never, ever wanted the fame. So I never, it wasn't something like I was hungry for it. I was never hungry for it. I just wanted to have an experience. That was it. I could never have foreseen past that. So I think because I never set myself up to fail, I just was like, well, I'll just go and, like, this will be great. And I'll always be able to tell people about that time that I met some famous people on telly and got to sing in front of them. And that was it. That's genuinely all it was. And I'm grateful for that. Because if I'd went really wanting it, it might have been a different experience. And I never did want it.
But boy, did you get it. Jeez. So you go and do that first audition. You were quite surprised to be put through. I remember that. Wow.
It was all very new. And again, very terrifying and very exciting in equal measures. But again, I was just down for the weekend and I was going home. You know, it was never going to get through. And it was always just moment by moment, experience by experience. It was, there was never a long game for me, ever. Never in a million years, my goodness.
So that was the heats where we decide who go through to the live finals. And it was so much fun to be a part of for me at that time, because I'd already had one go round the lap, in the previous year. So I kind of knew some of what was coming. But mm-hmm. How did you handle the pressure and then ultimately the attention that came with it? Because week by week, your profile grew. And then suddenly, within literally a handful of weeks, you are just Michelle from Pop Idol, right? You're a bit like Kylie. Like, people didn't have surnames. It was Will, Gareth, Darius the year before. It was Sam, Mark, Michelle in your year. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's that quick in terms of the fast track to fame.
Yeah. I mean, I feel we were really protected because we were inserted in that bubble really quick off the mark. So therefore, when I found out I was in there in the live shows in the final 10, which became 12 for the wildcard week because they added another two, we were moved to this room, that really posh house near Primrose, like how we were living. And it was like, I had never seen anything like this in my life. And we were all living in the one house, and Barney and Amelia, the production guys, were practically living with us. And life was just incredible. We were getting taken into blacked out cars and going here and going there. And like every week, it was such a positive show. There was never a sob story. You know, one week we're going to Elton Towers. The next week we're going to Love Actually premiere. The next week Elton John's coming to just be in a studio with us, play the piano, and we're all around the piano singing for Elton, which was insane.
I remember that. You almost had kittens that day, didn't you? You were a bit freaked out when Elton John turned up.
Not as much as Chris Hyde, I was, because initially I was like, oh my God, that is the best lookalike I've ever seen. Like, Pop Idol have went really over the top. And then the closer he got, I was like, oh my God, it's Elton John. And do you know, it was really funny because I don't remember this, but the production team told me, because what Elton John had done was he was then sitting getting interviewed on his own. And they said, who do you think is going to win Pop Idol? And he said, I'll tell you who I think it's going to win. It's going to be. And it went, and it, you know, bleeped out his answer. And at the very, after I won and everything was happening, and we were sitting in the room, apparently I said to one of the production guys, can I ask you a question? Who did Elton say was going to win? And they're like, what? And they're like, oh, we'll double check. And she came back, oh yeah, it was you. And they showed me the tape without the bleep. And it was me. How did my brain even remember that? For weeks later, I was like, I always wondered who Elton had said. And he was so kind about me in the press afterwards. For years later, Elton John spoke about me and used me as an example of someone who he thought was going to do really well from the show and hadn't in terms of their music career, and what a shame it was. And he was so kind to remember, you know, my name leaving his lips. And I was just like, oh my goodness, Elton John still knows my name. You know, that was a long time ago, but still. And those things kind of were such a huge, and still are such a huge deal to me, because these are mega global mega stars we're talking about. You know, we're not talking about a guy just saying me, no offense, in the Working Men's Club. This is like Elton John. It was amazing.
Bloody John.
It's Elton, he's a bloody legend. John. So the way I dealt with the showcase was we always had something lovely to do, and we're filming Me You every day. And everything, one day we were filming Halloween stuff, you know, we're all getting dressed up at the house. Aunt and Dec would come on the show, and you would have guests on the show, and we would have getting to know you, you know, us revealing a little bit more to the viewer and all that kind of stuff. So there was so many amazing things happening, but all that noise that was getting bigger and bigger on the outside world, I really wasn't hearing an awful lot to a lot of it, especially not until I got down to the kind of final four. And then I was like, oh, okay, this is, and it really ramped up at that point because there was a chance I was going to get in the final. So all of that noise ramped up. But certainly for the first 6-7 weeks, it was just like you had won the lottery and you were living your best life and you were in this kind of dreamlike state. It was amazing.
I'm so glad it was that for you. Because I know that there was some, I know that, the, you know, that noise seeped in not long after. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot to deal with. But I'm glad that that experience, the one that we could control for you as best we could.
It was amazing.
It was a good one. Talk me through the night of the final, because you had gone from being, you know, the girl that everybody liked and loved, and then it started to get serious, and then you were still there, and then suddenly we're like, and I think you were the same, oh, shit, she might win. Like, she could win. Up until then, it was always deemed like pretty boy territory, not pretty boys, but, you know, handsome young boys that somebody like Simon Cowell knew had, you know, exactly what to do with. But the year before, you know, the public had voted against what he thought was a slam dunk. Right? Mm. Gareth didn't get the majority of the votes. Will did. Both of them, very, by the way, very handsome men. But Will was a slightly different artist. And I think that was ringing in everybody's ears that I don't actually think that Sam and Mark have got this in the bag, because Michelle's coming up hard on the outside lane, you know? Mm. Did you feel that you were a contender at that point?
Never. And never for a minute. So I never thought they would let me win. No, but you said something really lovely to me when we were filming. So in my mind at that point, I was like, I'll get to a point, but they'll never let me win. And you said something really lovely, and you said, but you, Michelle, you must remember. And it's something I've forgotten, Kate, I'm sad I'd forgotten it for all the time that's passed. They never got to decide. It was always the public that got to decide, because we're so conditioned now to TV talent shows, whether it's Strictly or The Voice. Ultimately, it all comes down to the judges. The public can vote, but when it gets to the final two, the judges have the final say. It's never down to the public anymore. But at that point, with Pop Idol, it was 100% down to the public. The judges had no input in on that. So I think in my mind, I was always just thinking, they'll find a way, they'll do something, I'll not win.
I knew there was, like, you know, there was great integrity around the phone vote, in as much as we had to play it completely straight, and only if certain people were privy to it. That none of us knew who had polled first position, second position, third position, until after the show had been completed, the series had been done. Mm-hmm. So, though, you know, I could just see and sense what was building. By the last few weeks, suddenly the discussion turned not to your voice, but to your size and your shape. I remember it, Michelle, as being difficult. And I'm really sorry that all of that judgment took the shine off such a special experience for you.
I think the thing was, I was completely aware of who I was as a person. I knew at that point I was a size 20, 22. It wasn't a big shock to me that, you know, why are people thinking I'm really fat? I was overweight, and there's no denying that. But I think because I had honestly spent my life with people just accepting me who I was, you know, I was never bullied at school or anything. I was so lucky at school that I didn't have to go through what so many of my friends had went through. When you actually think someone like me probably was textbook in terms of who would get bullied at school, and I wasn't, because I always sang and joked with folk and had a great time. So somewhere in the pit of my stomach, I knew this was coming, right? But I'm now answering this question as a 43-year-old woman who is, you know, really strong, secure, in control of her own life. Where I was at 23 years old, and we talk about this brand new, shiny out the wrapper, 23-year-old in London, I did not have a clue how to deal with this. I wasn't mentally equipped for it. I wasn't emotionally able to deal with it. And there's one thing not to be liked, but there's one thing to be absolutely, you know, kind of vilified and hated because of how you look. And it really did, and this is no exaggeration, it got to that point. It got to the point where they were debating it in the House of Commons. A DJ got sacked on air for calling me, you know, I think it was like, I don't know if I can swear on this, I'm sure I can, yes, I'm not sure. And it was just like, we can't let that fat bastard get to number one again, or we can't let that fat bastard, it was something like that, and they were sacked, and it was all over the press. And, you know, you had the likes of, like, Dominic Mohan and The Sun had written this article saying, like, you know, can she sing? Yeah. Is she talented? I suppose so. But come on, lads, you just wouldn't, would you? And then it was a question of whether you would, I shouldn't win because you wouldn't want to sleep with me. You know, and just this, that whole, the sexualization of this 23-year-old wee girl who all I was asking the world was, do you think I can sing? You know, it was never a question of, do you want to go to bed with me? Or am I attractive enough? Or would you be embarrassed in front of your mates to say that you fancy me? But just at the time we were in 2003, all of that stuff, and we've been talking about it recently, all of that stuff was just fair game. It was rife. Everyone was going through it. You put yourself on telly, you deal with the consequences of it, which would have been fine if I was someone that was even a tiny bit equipped to deal with that, but I wasn't eyeing the singing contest.
I don't think anybody's equipped for that though, Michelle, because it's so wrong. It's so wrong and it's so unfair. And if you imagine, I mean, yeah, the misogyny of the
it's
way
the misogyny.
In which it was reported. And, you know, listen, I had shades of that, but nothing on that scale. Nothing on that scale. And, I mean, I think we can both agree that it wouldn't happen today, but the fact that
Thank goodness.
At all is a disgrace. Yeah. And that's when that started to happen, I think that's when I really felt so protective towards you. I think because I knew you felt so horribly attacked. I couldn't stop that. None of us could. And I think everybody in that group felt the same towards you. We just wanted to look after you. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to make sure you were okay. As best we could.
But I want you to know, and I know I've kind of said it, you know, at the beginning, I want you to know that you absolutely did that and then some, because I don't think I was even aware at the time of what you guys were. I mean, I was aware of how much you were taking care of me, but only now that I reflect and I look back in my life and the place that I'm in now, and I think it would have been a really different story for me, Kate, if you hadn't done that for me. Because see, at the end of the day, it wasn't because you didn't like me or the guys didn't like me, but your career at that point, and it still is, it was just, you moved from one thing to another. You were so, so busy. So for you then to make the time and go, no, she needs to come with us. You know, we still need to take care of her even though the show is finished. Like, if you hadn't have done that for me at that time, because let me tell you, as much as I had the record label around about me and I had my management company around about me, no one was taking care of me at that point in that respect. You know, that absolute, what I needed was a friend, a community, a number to call that if I needed to just go somewhere. So that was really, I think for me, surviving those first few months in London, if I hadn't had that, and with Lisa as well, and that little team around about me, I don't know what I would have done. On reflection, looking back now, I'm even surprised that I managed to get through it, even with all that help. Because it's like, I don't think, you know, it was just a crazy thing to happen to someone. Mad. And only it only happens to so few people, really. That kind of 0 to 100, you know, in terms of being famous.
You put your parent hat on now. Would you let your kids go through that?
No. Okay. Kate, I don't even put pictures of my kids on social media. I put one picture of both my boys when they were very first born, just because there was actual paps outside the hospital, which is insane in Glasgow, right? Because we don't really have paps here. But they all wanted that first picture of my kids, because nothing very much happens up here, not that often anyway. But
not true.
But you know what I mean? It's seen as a big deal. But I won't do that to them, because with social media now, right, it's an amazing place. It can also be like a bit of a moral sewer,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's the reason I wouldn't do it, because I thought, I think if I could guarantee you the team that, if I could guarantee our kids the team that you had before the noise seeped in, great. But beyond that, it's beyond everybody's control now. So I think you need to have a little bit of life experience under your belt before you can handle what fame looks like in 2023.
If I was going to Pop Idol now, the woman that I am now, oh my goodness, I mean, it would be a completely different experience. And, you know, in some ways, I'm glad it happened then, and I was so innocent and naive to it all, because I think knowing what I know now, I probably wouldn't last a minute in that environment. You know, not with you guys in terms of the production team, but just dealing with the press and all that kind of stuff, I wouldn't have lasted. I'd have been like, forget it.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The girl I met in the queue then became a megastar, and I want to talk to you about her. Talk Talk me through the night of the final.
So what had happened was the night of the final came and you guys were all amazing and everything was great. But there was an air of just something wasn't quite right in the studio. Something wasn't quite right and I felt it and I couldn't really describe it and I still can't describe it. But there was just an impending doom in me thinking, I don't think if I win, this is going to be a great thing. And part of me was like, I think I just want Mark to win because then it'll be easier for me. And, you know, because I don't really know what comes next. And I didn't want this part of it to end because this part of it had been so amazing as the show and the bubble that we speak about and all this kind of stuff. And I didn't want to not do this on a Saturday night. I didn't want to not see you. I didn't want to not see all these people in this environment. I wanted it to last just a few more weeks. We always want more, right? And then when I'm on stage with Ant and Dec, and it's funny because I have to question sometimes, Kate, whether I do remember it or whether I remember what I saw now on telly. It's really weird to try and...
Yeah, I get that.
Because I spent so many years after winning the show not thinking about it. Not because I wasn't proud of Pop either. I just couldn't really deal with everything that had happened at the time. But I just remember standing there and I remember looking out. And no matter where I was, I could always see my dad because he was dressed up in some wild outfit that he wore every week.
Yeah, it was always... Yeah, he really was, wasn't he? He represented...
Oh, it was always a theme in Pop Idol. One week was the Beatles week, then it was Elton John week, it was disco week. And my dad came dressed up. Don't ask me why, because he just thought that would be a great idea. But I remember looking out to my family and I remember just thinking, and I remember, you know, Dec saying, and the winner of Pop Idol 2003 is, and I just remember that moment thinking, it needs to be Mark because I don't know what's going to come next. And then he said my name. And you can actually, I didn't realise then, but you see me drop down, like I almost like go to fall, but I kind of pull myself back up again. And Dec's got my arm. And I just remember looking out and my mum and dad were crying and they were screaming and my sisters. And I looked and at the same time, I could see Pete Waterman just leaving the studio for whatever reason. You know, I'm sure, I know he spoke to you about it in the time since, but for me that was agonizing to see that because I could physically see him take off his tight.
Pete had been very vocal about the fact that he didn't think that you had what it took to be the full package, and this was in a time when looks really mattered in terms of how record companies signed acts. You know, there's no way Adele would have been signed back then, for example, but Pete, I mean, did it feel cruel to you, Michelle?
It was a real mixed emotion because I adored Pete Waterman. I grew up with Stock Cake and Waterman and that machine, and it gave me all of my favourite artists. I mean, I was a gigantic Kylie fan and Rick Astley and Sonia. So even though Pete was never rude to me, Pete always just said, look, I'm not saying you can't sing, but you're not going to make it in this industry. And unfortunately, he was absolutely right. I didn't make it in the industry, but at the time... He wasn't being nasty. He wouldn't let that go week after week. Even if I'd done a good performance, he always had to get that in, and that was fine.
But when I think he felt that there was a backroom tussle going on.
There was. I know that
between the Simons, and I'll let Pete speak of that because that's his narrative to share, I guess. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, I think he felt that he was being the dispenser of tough love, that he liked you very much. I know he liked you very much and he loved your voice.
Yeah. And the thing was, I think it was just watching him because he pulled his mic off, and I'll never forget it because he had this mic and he kind of threw it down and he didn't even wait for me to sing the song. Now, rightly or wrongly, Kate, he was a professional. He probably could have stayed to the end and then aired his views afterwards. So you've got Pete in my eye line here, but my family are kind of up here and I'm watching them all cheering. And then I see someone running over to Pete to try and convince him to stay, and he's not staying. And I think that was, you know, that it was so symbolic of the fact that here was me. This was the first reaction of anyone in the professional world of music, and this was their reaction of, you know, this is it. I'm not even going to allow her to sing her final song, which really cut deep. And I tried to deal with it with humour because I'd wore that Mrs. Waterman t-shirt at the big next big life thing I did and tried to make a joke of, oh, he really loves me, really. But it did cut really deep because I, you know, he was someone I had really, and still do, greatly admire. It doesn't change how I feel about Stock Cake and Waterman. You know, the guy's a legend in the music industry. I will never say a bad word about him. But reflecting now, I hope that he would look back in that time and go, you know, I stand by what I said. You know, he was right. He was absolutely probably right. But maybe I could have waited until the show was over to do that. And I think we would both agree on, you know, I would, agree with his views, and I think hopefully you would agree with what I'm saying too.
You said that Pete was right, that you didn't make it in this business. Wrong. You are 20 years on, making a documentary that's going to go out on Christmas Day, reflecting back on your time. You have your one-woman show, you have your radio show, you've released countless records, and you are still doing this as a living. And that, my friend, is success in this business. So don't you ever, ever destroy your own narrative.
I know. I love you for saying that. And you're right. I think what I meant was I was never going to have that music career. You know, that I was never going to have album after album after album. And it just wasn't the right time for me. And that was just, that was a fact. Like, I wouldn't change the time. It was right for me in every other respect. It just wasn't the right time. I just don't think folk were ready for someone who looked like me at that point to be anywhere near successful. And I do look at women, and I hate to, you know, mention Adele and Lizzo, because again, I'm mentioning them because of their weight, and I don't want to do that.
Sorry,
but
I'm the same.
No, I know, but I know exactly why you're doing it. But what I'm saying is, thank God we're in a world now where you can be whoever you want to be, and you can shine, and you can absolutely have a career, you know, in music, and you can be selling out to millions of people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in stadiums and all the rest of these women do. You know, Adele's a residency in Las Vegas every single week. Can't get a ticket for Love Nor Money. She's like, tell me a bigger star. She's won Oscars and Grammys and you name it, she's done it. Lizzo's the same. So I think, thank goodness we're at a point now where this is like such a distant memory. You know, it's like it would never, ever happen. And I think it would have been easier for me to take Kate if folk were like, she's just not that good a singer. But I think everyone was quite agreed that, yeah, she's like got a nice voice, she can definitely sing. It was just, I was never going to make it because of, I didn't present myself in a way that was acceptable to the industry in terms of selling merchandise and, you know, everything else that needed to go along with just being a singer. Being a singer wasn't enough at that point. And that's just the way it was.
How did all of this impact your mental health?
Oh, I mean, I think only now, and having been into therapy really recently, like in the last couple of years. I went into therapy a couple of years ago because after I had my first wee baby, I was like, oh my God, something's going to happen to me or something's going to happen to my baby. And I was in lockdown and I thought, I'm maybe going to speak to someone. And when I spoke to the therapist, she said, your fear's not about losing your baby. Your fear is that you don't feel you deserve your baby because of everything, that the narrative that was driven home for such a long time, that you don't deserve to win, you don't deserve to be... And it really kind of made me then go back and address it. And I think only now I realise as an adult that it did affect my mental health. And again, mental health wasn't something we spoke about in 2003. You know, I think honestly in 2003, I think if I had tried to speak about it, a lot of what I was getting back was, why are you moaning? You're famous. Why are you moaning? You know, you shouldn't be moaning.
Or if you don't like it, lose weight.
Yeah, if you don't like it, lose weight. And I did lose the weight. I went, which is exactly what I did. So not long after I won, I went and did Gillian McKeith, You Are What You Eat. What an experience that was, by the way.
So let's just point out, right, you released a single. The night that you released your first single, it went straight in at number one. It was huge, yeah? It was called All This Time.
Yeah, it was number one for 3 or 4 weeks or something in January, but now...
And then the second single didn't enter at number one. And then suddenly they're going, oh,
no,
isn't working. So there's no chance to sort of recalibrate, rebuild... resuscitate, you know, or there was nobody sat there going, but hang on a second, this woman has picked up, you know, millions of votes. There's millions of people out there that bothered to vote for us. So there's millions of people that have probably got an appetite to listen to her sing. We need to go again. Right? Nobody did that. Why not?
Oh, God. So the way it was presented to me was, is that the single came out and it went straight to number one. It was number one for 3 or 4 weeks. And, you know, it was like, I made it into the Guinness Book of World Records because I was the first Scottish female to ever debut at number one. In fact, there was an episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
And Lulu was furious.
Oh, I mean, Queen Lulu. I love Lulu, right? I've met her since, oh my God. But there was a question on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and the poor guy lost 16 grand because it was like, which Scottish female debuted at number one? You know, was it Charlize Viteri, Lulu, Annie Lennox or Michelle McManus? And he took a 50-50 on it. It was between me and Lulu. And of course you're going to think it was Lulu, but Lulu's first single didn't go to number one. It was her second or third single, but it was my first single. Anyway, so the single did really, really well. And then my album was a lot of ballads, but there was one fast song on the album. And I had begged them to let me do that as my second single. And they said, no, it's going to be The Meaning of Love. And it was another ballad. Little did I know they'd given that song to one of the American Idol runners-up, and she released it 6 months after I had recorded it. It was one of those things. And I didn't know that at the time, and I was devastated. And I remember the album did really well. I think the album went to, like, number two or something like that. But it came out in Brit Week, so it was kind of lost in that. And then the second single came out, and I remember getting my call sheet for the week, and I had one appearance on Des and Mel on a Wednesday, which was a great programme, but there was no other promo. And I remember saying, should we not be doing other things for this second single? Because the first single had been promoed to death, like up and down country. And he said, no, one appearance will be enough. And then the midweeks came out, and it was number 13 in the midweeks. And they were like, oh, well, it was great while it lasted, but, you know, that's it over now with the music. And I was like, sorry, we've got a whole album. And okay, I was like, don't worry, we're going to find something else for you to do. Don't you worry, we'll give you a wee call. And I literally left 19 offices that day, and I was like, but we've got, it's only Wednesday, we've got till Sunday until the, are we not going to try and push it? No, usually where you are in the midweeks is where you'll stay. It was all this, and I was like, oh, okay. And I thought, oh, they must have another plan for me. And that was the end of the music career right there, right then. And then a couple of months later, I got a letter saying you've been dropped by Sony BMG, and my management company said, look, what would you like to do? Would you, you know, like to be a TV presenter? Would you like to lose weight? Would you like to be a radio presenter? Would you like to lose weight? Would you? And this all kept coming back to this weight loss thing. And I was like, okay, I'll lose the weight. If you think that'll make people love me and I'll get my music career back, then yeah. And I lost 10 stone with Gillian McKeith, and it didn't make a blind bit of difference. 10 stone, which took 10 stone in 10 months, because I wanted to sing.
Is that even healthy?
Well, it was all very healthy food and all that. I had a lot of weight to lose, and I'd never tried to diet like that before, so it just kind of fell off me. But it made no difference. I didn't get a record deal. They still weren't interested, even though I called their bluff and went and lost all the weight, and the record company were like, nah, it's gone. It's done. And that was it. And it was done.
You must have been broken by that decision.
Oh, I didn't know how to tell mum and dad because they were so proud of me, and it happened so quick. So I won in end of 2003. 2004 was spent, you know, first half great doing the single and the album, and then the second half of 2004 just plodding about London, going out for drinks with you and just trying to keep going. And then 2005 came, and I lost the weight with Gillian McKeith and all the rest of it. And then by 2006, it was over. I mean, it had been over way before that, but it was really over. And I remember going to see my lawyer, because that's the only person I knew in the industry that would talk to me at the time, was my lawyer, lovely Anne Harrison. I don't know what I'd have done without her. And I went to see Anne, and Anne just said, look, I'm getting you out of this contract. You're not staying with me, you know, you're not staying with your management company. And I was all but out of it anyway. She said, but I'm going to legally get you out of it. And I said, but where do I go, Anne? What do I do? And she went, I'm going to introduce you to someone. And she introduced me. She went, go for lunch here. You're meeting this man called Alan. Just go and see him. And I went, and I met Alan and Mark Wogan, who ran Joe Garnett Management Company at the time. And they had all the boys from Radio 2. So they had Ken Bruce, Steve Wright, all the rest. But they had no females on their books at that point. And a lovely woman called Alison Sloan, who came from Sanctuary Records. And Alison's still my manager to this day. And the boys just met me, and they said, just come with us. Whatever you want to be, you're going to be with us. And I said, I don't want to do music anymore, and I just don't think it's going to work. And they said, are you sure? You know, you're a great singer. And I said, no. And they had great connections at the BBC because they were Wogans and stuff like that, and they just were so well connected. Yeah, Alan's so gorgeous. He looked like Colin Firth. It was like a real life Mr. Darcy. I could barely speak during the lunch. I was like, are you real? Because you're so gorgeous, which doesn't bode well when he's going to be your manager. Ali and I still laugh about it to this day. He was honestly, he's one of the most gorgeous men I've ever seen in my life. And they just took me on, Kate, and they changed everything. They changed everything for me. And they helped me carve out this lovely career that I have now. And it all starts with them.
Well, actually, it all starts with you. And it starts with the fact that I would have sat there in Alan and Mark's shoes and gone, hang on a minute, like I've just said to you, millions of people voted for this woman because they had access to her on a weekly basis and they fell in love with her. So that is proven. What do we do to build on that? Mm-hmm. And that's where I would have gone. And I'm guessing that's kind of what they did.
Oh, I mean, I started off doing the Eurovision results. So I was doing From High from Scotland and all that kind of stuff when they were doing the kind of heats and things. They got me straight in with BBC Scotland. I then got the job at STV, which is ITV in Scotland, hosting their version of The One Show that ran for 4 years at 5 o'clock called The Hour. It was wildly successful. We had Brian May. We gave Ed Sheeran his very first TV appearance, and he gave me a shout out at Hampden a couple of years ago, and he said, Scotland, okay. Michelle McManus. And it wasn't me, it was the show, but you know, the show was hugely successful in Scotland. All the big names that were coming up to perform here came on our show, on our sofa. And then after that, when the show kind of ended, I then thought, you know, I've got an amazing comedy writer called Bruce Devlin up here. He's one of the top compares. And he said, let's do a one-woman show because, you know, you're quite funny and you're quite up for taking the piss out yourself. And we devised this idea of this woman that had had 15 minutes of fame and it was up and she didn't know it was up and she still thought she was mixing with all these, you know, really famous people like Beyonce, but actually she was opening her local Lidl on a Saturday. You know, that was cutting the red ribbon. So we kept... what was born from that was this kind of comedy cabaret, kind of like me thinking I was Liza Minnelli, you know, like on stage with these people, like, and it went down a storm and we ended up selling out the festival for 7 years and then that transferred to TV and we were doing TV specials with me and then I get to sing for the Pope and for the Queen's Jubilee and I opened up the Commonwealth, we hosted the Commonwealth Games up here. It just all right. starts to go bang, 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 bang,
Let me
bang,
just
bang,
unpick
bang,
that,
bang.
Right? That's not you in the show. In your fantasy, like your, this sort of alter ego you're playing, you actually sang for the Pope. You actually sang for the Queen. You, Michelle McManus, not Michelle McManus, the Edinburgh Fringe play Michelle McManus, right? So when you talk about that your career in music didn't work, I'm going to really hold a mirror up to you now and say, really, how's that not working when you sing for the Queen and the Pope many years after you've been voted the winner?
I know, and you're right, and it's only now in my life where I'm getting a chance to hold that mirror up and look back. I think it's just because in the very traditional sense of having album deals and all this kind of stuff, that part didn't work for me. It's that very that kind of traditional recording artist part didn't work for me, but you're right, all these lovely things, and I have to also mention the LGBTIQ plus community, because in between all of this happening, this community literally just opens its arms up and goes, you come to us, and I start performing all these major kind of gay venues up and down the country, and Pride events, Manchester Pride. I meet Rylan at Manchester Pride in 2013 and that then begins a friendship there. And, you know, Khalees is on the same stage and all these kind of people. And I end up doing Mighty Hoopla in London last year of 30,000 people because of that community, you know. And they were just like, listen, see, if no one else wants you, you better just come along here with us because we love you and we accept you, whatever you look like, whatever you are. You know, you can be an honorary member of that community, and that has never left me, that amazing community. Like, I don't know where I would be without, you know, without the LGBTIQ plus community and that such. So all these lovely things start happening till I get to this point now, you know, where I'm like 20 years down the line and I can look back now through completely different eyes, and I can maybe be proud of myself, Kate, which I wasn't for a long time, because for such a long time there was a lot of shame attached to it as well, because I thought, I did this, I let myself down, I didn't get the record deals, and people didn't want to hear from me because it's all my fault, because I wasn't good looking enough and I wasn't thin enough and I wasn't attractive enough, because that's what you're told, so therefore that's just what you believe. And only now I think, with this documentary and taking this time and speaking to you and hearing what your view was at that time, only now can I look back and go, do you know, Michelle, you did good and it did work out okay and you have a lovely life as a result, and I know that and I am really happy with it.
If I'd have gone and tapped you on the shoulder in that queue 20 years ago and said, listen, this is what's going to happen, take it or leave it, right? You're going to win, it's going to get bumpy afterwards, there's going to be a lot of self-reinvention, but you'll never go and do a 9-to-5, you'll never get out of bed and go, oh, I don't want to go to work today. You're always going to be able to do something you love that challenges you, you're going to meet extraordinary people. Hey, you might even sing for the Pope and the Queen. What do you reckon? Would you have signed on the dotted line?
Oh, I'd have grabbed it with both hands. And then some, of course I would have. And this is why I'm incredibly grateful.
I'm really
grateful.
Sorry about the shit bit in the middle. I mean, I think...
Oh, it wasn't your fault.
I think that, yeah, but you did have a bit of a shit sandwich, babe.
I did, and
I
looking
think the
back
bit in the middle
now,
was terrible.
But, you know, isn't it lovely that nobody else will really need to go through that, I don't think. You know, that and by the way, loads of people went through it before me. It just wasn't publicly on telly, you know, people trying to get in the record business with who looked like me or, you know, sounded like me or whatever, so... But I think the positive always outweighs the negative in that situation. And I do look back in my life now, and you're right, I am so lucky that I can provide for my family in the way that I do, and I get given the opportunities that I do. And, you know, I'm producing on this documentary now, you know, I'm getting credits on there. I've just written, we've got a new song coming out on Friday that I've written, you know, I'm writing for other people and I'm at the table making decisions now, as opposed to just like, just you go home and we'll phone you if we've got any news for you. And even that, you know how empowering that is as a woman in our industry. It's, I feel very proud that I'm in that position.
Oh, I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
I am. Look at you.
Don't, you're going to start me crying again. You're wild. You've got a little button you can press. You just say things and I just start crying. You know, I do look back. I hope I'm not being too negative. I do look back really only positively on the whole thing.
I think you've been entirely positive, but I want to end on a high, and I want to talk to you before I let you go about the woman that you are today, because so much has changed. Let me pick up with Michelle McManus, 2023, mother of two, wife of Jeff. How did that happen? And today, how are you? Are you good in yourself?
Do you know, Kate, I sometimes get scared to say it out loud, but I'm so freaking happy, man. I am like, good. I'm so content. I think content's the word I always come back to when I'm trying to sum up my life. Like, everything I needed in these four walls, do you know what I mean? I've got my husband and I adore him. I wasted a long time to meet Jeff. I was 35. You know, I didn't really date anyone before Jeff, and I never really thought I was going to meet anyone like Jeff, but he is, you know, marriage is hard. Of course it's hard. You know, I'm not going to pretend to sit here and go, yeah, of course it is. It will, nothing will test you, you know, like having two small children under three. But I feel like he's my running mate, man. I feel like he's my partner in crime, and like, I believe every word that comes out of his mouth and I trust him. And I think, you know, he just does, he gets me. He just does, he's not in the industry. He's a mechanical engineer, and he just, I don't know, I think we're on the same page, which is really difficult sometimes to be on the same page with someone. I mean, I can't predict the future, right? I can just tell you what's happening right now. Even though it is hard going, and sometimes we're like passing ships in the night, you know, with these kids, we always find a way back to each other. And I think, I just feel like we're both on the same page. I'm not being very articulate, but he's just, he is my total teammate in this. And I love him, but I couldn't do it without him. We are 50-50 in it. And I think that I needed that. Not everyone needs that, but I needed that. I needed that in a person. And I got that in him.
Where was Jeff hiding all these years?
Well, you know, we're white wines in the title. So it's like, of course there was booze involved, because I had a, it was 2015, right? So I had been down in London because I was doing Kudos at the time, the panto up here. There's a big, massive panto in the Armadillo. It's like a 3,500 seater. And I was playing the mermaid and Peter Pan, and David Hasselhoff was Captain Hook. And the crankies, who are out of this world.
You were a mermaid with the crankies and David Hasselhoff. This is the sort of conversation I normally only have with Denise Welsh. This is how random her life is.
Yeah, I'd hit my panto ceiling at this point. I was never going to get any better than this than doing the panto with the crankies and David Hasselhoff. So I was down in London getting fitted for my mermaid costume, and my lovely pal Kat Harvey, who presents on Greatest Hits in Scotland here on The Breakfast Show.
Yeah, Kat, from Kat and Ewan.
Yeah, from Kat and Ewan, right. She loves you. But she... Kat phoned me, and she's like, what a riot she is, right? She was my drinking buddy, and then some. So Scotland, the national team, were playing Germany, and of course we were going to get beat, because Scotland at that point were always getting beat. And she said, let's just preempt the situation. We're going to get gubbed at football, so I'm going to want to commiserate and have a couple of drinks. And I live near the national stadium. She's over in the west end of the city. She said, I'm going to meet you after the game. I said, no, Kat, I'm in London. My train doesn't even get to 8:30 at night. I'm working in Sunderland, of all places, tomorrow we're filming. I can't come out. Anyway, I went out, went to the pub under duress, right? My first drink was a double Jack Daniels.
You haven't changed.
I know.
I can't. I'm on live television tomorrow. Just the one, then.
But my first drink was a double Jack Daniels and Diet Coke with a Zambuca shot, right? So that was like the first drink, because Kat's nuts, right? So I meet Kat, and we're in the pub, and then these two guys come in. It's rammed in this pub because it's so close to the stadium. It's full of football fans, and these two guys come in, and there was a wee seat beside us, so they said, oh, look, can we sit down? And they sat down, and one was Jeff. And I had went to the bar or something to get a drink, obviously, because I'd, you know, had only had 1-2 minutes before it. So I went to the bar, and Jeff had said to Kat, is that Michelle McManus? And Kat said, yes, it is, uh-huh. And he said, you know, I really love her. I think she's amazing. He said, I've met her a couple of times. She won't remember. He said, but... do you think, you know, can I talk to her kind of thing? And Kat's like, well, what are your intentions? Where are you from? You know, she's giving them the third degree. Anyway, so Kat said, look, this guy wants a picture with you. And I said, yeah. So Jeff sat beside me and we took a picture, and I still have that picture in a frame, because we did not know each other. And that was the moment that we both met. And after that, he was just, he just really made me laugh, Kate. And he actually, you know, I could barely get a man to buy me a kebab on the way up the road at that point, never mind what he'd actually, like, date me or, like, ask for my number. And he just, he said, look, I want to take you for dinner. And I was like, really? And I said to Kat, I said, he's really gorgeous. I really like him. And Kat said, well, look, you know, let's go have a couple of drinks with him. And we did. And he texted the next day when I was going to Sunderland, and he texted the day after, and it just happened. And I was 35 at that point, and I genuinely never thought I was going to meet anyone. I just had resigned myself to the fact that, like, it's not going to happen for me. And then I met Jeff, and it literally went bang. Like, we were living together after 6 months. We were engaged after, like, 8 months, married after 2 years. And then we had these two beautiful babies, and we bought our house. And 8 years down the line, you know, here we are. And, you know, I'm like, what if I had never went to that pub that night? What if I'd never... Gosh, yeah. What if Kat hadn't dragged me out, lured me out with the promise of veg pakora, which is like, the veg pakora up here is like amazing. It's like the tastiest thing ever. You know, in that little white polystyrene container when you've had one too many sherries and trying to eat your pakora. But what if I hadn't went out? And he said the same. He wasn't supposed to come out that night, and his mate's like, let's just go for one pint. And it kind of gives me wee shivers when I think, you know, yeah, what if we hadn't met? Because I'd spent such a lot. I spent from winning Pop Idol to meeting him, that 15 years, didn't have a boyfriend. I dated folk, but it never came to anything. Never had a significant other, so I never had that love, even to lose. I never had it.
Well, that's because you just had to bide your time, because there it was in an abundance. The man that will go on to capture your heart and create two beautiful little boys with you.
I know.
And you've got the family that you kind of grew up with now.
I do. I am in a place in my life right now that I'm like, this is the moment I want to remember. These are the moments I want to remember, because I know I will look back in this period of my life, whatever is to come, and I will. This is the place I want to return to in my memory. I know I will. That's how I feel about it.
I'm so glad that you're happy. You deserve it. You're one of the nicest, sharpest, funniest, most talented, resilient women I've ever met. Honestly, you are, Michelle. And I wish you nothing but this times 10 going forward in life. And I hope that you don't have to bite down on another shit sandwich.
No, never, ever, ever again. It will never happen. No shit on the menu for moi. But it got me to where I am today, I suppose. I think that's the thing. And hopefully it helped others not to go through it, I think, as well.
Totally. Oh, it's been so nice picking up with you. I wish Scotland wasn't so far away. But next time I'm up shooting, I'm so coming to squeeze those kids.
I was going to say, you know, you've got a place to come. Yeah. Exactly, you've got a place to come here in Scotland any time.
How lovely was that? And Michelle's documentary, Michelle McManus, After All This Time, is out on the BBC at Christmas. It may even be airing on Christmas night. We're just waiting for the schedules to be firmed up. But fear not, you can always catch up with it on iPlayer. And for more chat with talent show legends, we have episodes with Libby Walsh, Danny Minogue, Craig Revel, Horwood, Arlene Phillips, that's Dame Arlene Phillips to you and I, Shirley Ballas, Nikki Chapman, and Amanda Holden in our back catalogue. In the meantime, I'll be back on Friday with a brand new guest. Until then, thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.